accession number 15240, real 1.
Mr. Hamilton, real 1. Where were you born, please?
Where was I born?
Yes.
In Dunbar, in Scotland, and very proud of it.
Which year was this?
1916.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a Royal Scot, the 1st Regiment. As you probably know, they were a pearl one in their ties. And he was shot to pieces almost at Gallipoli, but survived after 2 bullet wounds in his head, which is amazing. So I should have been a soldier, but it wasn't to be.
Did you go to school at Dunbar?
No, I haven't been back there.
Did you go to school there?
No, I went to school at Cheltenham to start with, which is where my father had been and his father, and then of course to Dartmouth, Royal Naval College, at the age of 13.
What did you think of your course at Dartmouth in those days?
Well, I was a very late developer, and like many public schools, games playing was an important factor, and I'm not a good games player, and I was in fact very miserable at Dartmouth. However, shortly after I left, I began to get self-confidence, and in fact in the courses that one did as a sub-lieutenant, I got all first-class certificates, and I think I ended up as probably the youngest lieutenant in the Navy at the time. But I had a very slow start. It is interesting that I went back to Dartmouth on the staff much later, in 1945, as a house officer. That was at the time when the whole system had been changed from one in which the boys were segregated rigorously by age to the house system, where in each house there were boys of all different ages. And this, although I was very much a traditionalist, I came to praise the courage of the then First Lord for altering the whole system, because I think a mixture of boys of all ages and backgrounds, it was probably beneficial to them all.
How many years did you do at Dartmouth as a boy?
Oh, the normal 3 years.
So we're talking about 29 to 32.
1930 to 33, in fact, yeah.
What was the quality of the staff like there?
The quality of the staff, excellent. And it's difficult for me to say this, as I was myself appointed back there on the staff, but the staff at Dartmouth always were hand-picked. That is, the officers in charge of the various terms of boys going through. It was a great honour to go back there on the staff, but I have to say, with all modesty, that my hearing and sight had been damaged in Malta in 1942, and for that reason I was not given another command, and I went back on the staff then. So it possibly was not through merit, but for those reasons that I went back on the staff. Nonetheless, it was a privilege.
Do you think that the course at Dartmouth prepared you adequately for what you had to do later, or do you have any criticisms?
I think it prepared one adequately, but one must remember that it was really, at that age, a continuation of a basic education. There was a certain amount of seamanship attached to it, of course, in the river, where one sailed in boats and that sort of thing. But most of the naval training took place later at Greenwich, when one was a sub-lieutenant, and subsequently in courses at Portsmouth for gunnery, torpedo, and so on.
Which ship did you first go to after your training?
Well, after Dartmouth, there was a training cruiser called the Frobisher, which took the boys to sea for a period immediately after their training at Dartmouth, and then as midshipmen afterwards they were appointed to various ships. My very first ship as a midshipman was the Malaya battleship.
Where did you serve in the Malaya?
She was showing the flag cruises, and I went to Norway, which is very interesting, right to the end of Hardangerfjord to Odda, and we did meet a few Norwegian people there, but I've always been a great admirer of Norway ever since. And in fact, I was in the Mari, which we'll come on to later, which actually took off the last of our troops when we evacuated Namsos.
We'll come on to that later.
Yes.
I think that you also had some experience pre-war of the Spanish Civil War.
Yes, but very limited. We took off some people. I can remember I was in a cruiser called the Sheffield at the time, but there was nothing glamorous about it. We were just taking off nationals who had nothing to do with the Civil War, didn't want to be killed.
Did you actually hear the announcement of war by Neville Chamberlain in 1939?
I didn't actually hear it myself, but I was then in the Mari at Wyberth in Alexandria Harbour, and the captain, who was Godfrey Brewer, a very distinguished and lovely man, who subsequently did extremely well, and he cleared lower deck and said, "Gentlemen, we are at war."
How did you react to that personally?
I think one reacted because in the sense that it was inevitable anyway, and it was a good thing in a way that it was started. It had to be done, and we realized that. I think we were confident in our own ability, particularly in the Mediterranean, where largely because of A.B. Cunningham, who had been the rear admiral destroyers, the destroyers in particular were probably the finest and best trained force of any sort ever in the history of man. I really mean that. He was an inspiration, and subsequently, of course, became commander-in-chief in the Mediterranean.
Can you be more specific about how he achieved that?
You mean how he achieved the reputation, you mean?
How he achieved that high quality amongst the destroyers.
Obviously an inspired man, a gentleman, considerate and well qualified and very experienced. And he engendered in everybody, from admirals to the smallest seaman boy, not only faith in his ability, but an affection. He's one of the great men of the war.
Did you meet him personally?
No, I never had that privilege. Just as an aside, at a reunion of the Penelope survivors held this February 1995, I met a petty officer, Wren, now aged 76, who was on Cunningham's staff in Alexandria. The girl called Frances Phillips. I think she was a petty officer telegraphist. And she worshipped the man. I mean, it was typical of the feelings of everybody. We knew that we couldn't lose the war in the Mediterranean in spite of the terrible loss of ships and manpower, because as long as Cunningham was there.
What were your own duties aboard Maori at the beginning of the war?
Well, I was. A tribal destroyer, as you probably know, has a commander probably in command, and then a fairly senior lieutenant as executive officer and second in command, and then another lieutenant. That was me, really third in line, if you like, and then engineer officer and whatever. So I was a young lieutenant. I joined the ship before she was completed at Govan, Fairfield's yard, and left her last when she was sunk. So I have a tremendous affection for the ship, as I was literally serving in her throughout her career.
But what were your specific responsibilities as third in command?
Well, I was the gunnery control officer and generally in charge of the ship under the first lieutenant. One thing I am not is a navigator. I have no affection for navigation. I have always been privileged to have good navigators in the ship who would do the job.
What kind of a ship was Maori to live and work in?
Oh, magnificent. The only thing is, of course, they were always at sea, because the British Navy has never had enough destroyers, and therefore they had to do duty as destroyers, as escort vessels, and every other duty of a destroyer. And we never had enough cruisers, and so they were thrown into battle to fight against overwhelming odds as well. So they were always at sea.
After the declaration of war, what duties did the destroyer then take up?
Well, the Maori in particular was sent back to home waters, because the Mediterranean was not the hot spot at that time. And we did a number of jobs in the Arctic and all over the place. We took part in the Norwegian campaign and took off the last survivors. May I elaborate on that for
Please,
a moment?
Please, if you would, give as much detail as you can.
Here is a tribute to the Royal Marines. We were in Namsos to take off the last of the troops when Norway was evacuated. It is interesting that the French chasseurs alpins had left their skis behind in France. We, that is the British, had sent some soldiers who had only just been trained in hobnail boots. And we understand that the German ski troops literally came down, whistling down the slopes, throwing hand grenades amongst these unfortunate soldiers who had barely been trained and standing there in their hobnail boots. It was a terrible fiasco. Finally, when it was decided that the Allied troops should be evacuated, we were alongside the harbour in Namsos, and the remains of our army straggled down to the beach in a total disarray, half of them with no ammunition, no rifles or anything, or tin hats or whatever. We were about to leave when we heard from behind a hill, "Royal Marines, change arms!" And a small detachment of Royal Marines marched down to the jetty, and a young officer, who must have been in his 20s, came up onto the bridge and saluted and said to our captain, "Royal Marines, correct, sir. I have never seen anything to touch this in my life. These young chaps, the Royal Marines, had held up the German advance to allow our recruits from the army to get down to the jetty, and had then marched down as if they were on a parade ground with everything perfect, and had even changed arms because they were getting slightly tired. It was the most magnificent tribute to the Royal Marines."
Any other memories you have from NAMSOS?
I'm afraid so, yes. The German aircraft strafing the civilians as they climbed the mountains to get away from the air raids. But perhaps I should say, having said that, I am now very pro the Germans and their efforts to unify Europe.
How long do you think Maury was at NAMSOS for?
You know, I cannot remember the question of hours, but we did finally, we were the last ship to leave, and that was that.
Was the town in flames?
I'm sorry?
Was the town of NAMSOS in flames?
Yes, I think it was, but yes, it was, but I cannot get a mental picture of it anymore. I do remember the unfortunate inhabitants leaving NAMSOS and climbing the mountains. But
what about the casualties and damage aboard Maury?
We lost, I think, two sailors during that episode, but the ship itself was not hit. It was not badly damaged.
How were the two sailors lost?
I think it must have been through bomb splinters, but I really cannot remember.
What's the next thing you remember after NAMSOS?
Well, there's nothing of any great importance that we did some Arctic work, which was cold, of course, but the next big episode in the life of the Maury was the Bismarck action. Well, I have some interesting comments about that. There are a number of aspects to the Bismarck action. To start with, I have been very keen on plotting ever since I was a midshipman, taking into account the strategical aspects, how to detect and to pursue the enemy and to bring it into action. The whole business of plotting has fascinated me, and as a midshipman I did a lot of it, and it was, I say this with the utmost modesty, recognized that I was very interested in the subject, and it subsequently did my career a lot of good. But the Bismarck action, taking a broad view, represented the last time, probably, that destroyers performed their traditional role, which was to find the enemy and either lead the enemy in the direction of our heavy ships so that the enemy could be destroyed. The destroyers should lay off and not be sunk themselves, but continuously report the position of the enemy so that our heavy forces could meet up with the enemy, and so on. And this is where Admiral Vian came into prominence for the second time after the Cossack business, when he rescued the survivors, about which we all know. There were, from the plotting point of view, ships looking for the Bismarck from every direction. There were the two cruisers in the Denmark Strait to the north. There was the home fleet coming from Britain. There were ships coming from the other side of the Atlantic. There was Force H coming up from Gibraltar. The whole Atlantic was one huge plot of ships, all aiming to detect the Bismarck and to shadow her and bring her to action with our heavy ships. It was the last of those traditional operations, particularly for destroyers. Another important point is that the age of the Air Force at sea was just about to dawn, and this was the last time, really, that destroyers on their own were taking part in a location shadowing and reporting exercise. And even then, as you know, the Bismarck was finally damaged by air attack, and her steering gear was put out of action, and that was a crucial point. So this is a major comment, I think, that this was a moment during the Bismarck saga when the air age overlapped the traditional age of the small ships and their duty to shadow and report and to damage and slow down the enemy.
What was your own action station during the Bismarck action?
Well, actually, I was standing beside the captain, and I should explain that there were four destroyers under Vian in the Cossack, which were in touch with the Bismarck on the final night after she had been relocated by a Catalina aircraft, having been lost in the fog. During the last night, Vian had to do two things. One, to slow the Bismarck down with torpedo hits, if he could do that, and at the same time make absolutely certain that at least one of his ships was not sunk so that she could continue to report the Bismarck's position. The home fleet, of course, was lumbering down from the north and would eventually bring her to action. So during the night we had the fascinating experience of one tribal at a time going in to attack with torpedoes while the other three lay off and reported the position. We actually hit the Bismarck with a torpedo, and I think at least one of the other tribals did as well. But such was the construction of the Bismarck, with the best German know-how and fabulous steel, that it made virtually no difference whatever to the Bismarck that we torpedoed her. We all saw a great burst of flame when the torpedo hit the Bismarck, and there were cheers, of course, from the sailors, but it made no difference whatsoever to the Bismarck's speed. Later on, in the morning, while it was very foggy and the other three tribals had lost touch, the Bismarck emerged out of a fog bank, and the Maori was the only ship left in contact. When you realize that the Maori was one destroyer and the Bismarck was the most powerful ship that perhaps the world has ever seen, and the distance between us was about 3,000 yards, it was certainly a moment in the lives of everybody present. There now comes a comment which I make with the utmost affection for my then captain, Captain Armstrong, commander as he then was, H.T. Armstrong, a very brave, tall-headed, red-haired Irishman, a wonderful man who was subsequently lost in the Lafare off Anzio. He said to me, as dawn broke, "Number one, I think we will finish the Bismarck off ourselves." And I said to him, "Sir, if I may say so, that would be a grave mistake. It is absolutely essential that Churchill can announce that our home fleet have caught up with the Bismarck and the British fleet has sunk her, and that is the end of the saga. For you to sink the Bismarck casually out of hand by torpedo from one destroyer would be an anticlimax of a terrible nature." Armstrong said to me, "Number one, I will have no more comments like that from you, and if I do, I will put you in irons, so help me." This was on the bridge of a destroyer in the middle of the Atlantic with the world's greatest warship 3,000 yards away in a fog bank. It was a moment I will never forget. Beaky Armstrong said, "I will stop the ship and turn very slowly, and the gunner T will fire the torpedoes himself." And he turned to the sub-lieutenant who had hit the Bismarck the night before and said, "I do not want any more operations from you. The gunner is to do it himself. And it is actually true that he put on 5 degrees of rudder and stopped the ship's engines to make absolutely certain that we hit the Bismarck with the torpedoes. As the first torpedo slid into the water, the Bismarck opened fire with all her armament. She was not disabled. One 15-inch shell went under our wireless aerials. Splinters hit the ship. The captain went full ahead and we made smoke, dropped smoke floats and smoke belching from the funnels and everything else. And we zigzagged and we got away and the Bismarck did not hit us. Subsequently, the home fleet made contact, and as you know, of course, they finally reduced the Bismarck to a scrap iron, but she did not sink. And to this day, it is not established whether or not the German sailors opened the seacocks and let the water in. However, the fact remains that she sank after being pounded to scrap metal by our heavy ships. And then the cruiser Dorsetshire and the Maori went in to pick up survivors. I think you have met George Clark, who speaks German, and he was a member of the crew of the Maori, and he shouted to the unfortunate German sailors that we were picking up out of the water that they must swim away from the ship because we had to go ahead with our screws going flat out because we received a U-boat warning and we had to leave the rest of the German sailors in the sea. It is something I will never forget.
What condition were the survivors in that you did pick out of the sea?
I have to be careful here because of war crimes. They were of two distinct types, the German sailors that we picked up. Many of them were exactly the same as our sailors. They were professional sailors, extremely good at their job, doing what they were taught, fighting for their country, honorable people, and were glad to be rescued. They were taken down below by our sailors, and the oil fuel washed out of their eyes. They were given hot drinks and whatever, clean clothes, with affection by our sailors. One lot of professionals talking to another lot of professionals and looking after them in their distress. On the other hand, there were a few members of the Hitler Youth who had recently, obviously, been recruited to the German Navy, who came on board and looked at the white ensign and spat on the deck. And they did not receive the same treatment. I will leave it at that.
Did they get a punch? Did anybody punch them because of that?
Well, I would rather not elaborate on that. But we had great affection for the old sweats from the German crew who were doing their job just like we were and had been through hell.
Did the Bismarck look a terrifying sight?
I don't think terrifying is the word. She looked like a magnificent wounded elephant. She was, of course, probably the most marvelous ship ever built. The Germans know how to build ships, and she was the finest example. Absolutely magnificent. And may I just add that the Bismarck